In celebration of his birthday, the Philadelphia Museum of Art will open an exhibit tomorrow of Cage's scores and prints. He's in Philadelphia for the opening of the show and is with me now in the studio. Cage's music has gone from ideas of order to ideas of no order. From music which was concerned with a systematic organization of the 12-tone scale, he studied with Arnold Schoenberg in the 30s, to music generated by chance processes. In 1937, Cage said, "Whereas in the past, the point of disagreement in music has been dissonance and consonance, it will be in the immediate future between noise and so-called musical sounds." He talked about wanting to capture and control sounds like the static between radio stations, the sounds of trucks going by, and use them not as sound effects, but as musical instruments. The following year, he created what he called the prepared piano, a method of altering the piano's tonal and percussive qualities by placing metal, wood, or rubber objects on the piano strings. And one of his later famous pieces, 4 minutes 33 seconds, is 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence that frames the sounds that are always dismissed or ignored as noise. Cage has been very influenced by ancient Eastern philosophy. He studied with D.T. Suzuki in the 50s, but at the same time he has pioneered musical uses of state-of-the-art Western technology in his work. Some of his chance compositions have used computers, others have used the ancient Chinese oracle, the I Ching. Using noise and chants and inspired by Zen Buddhism, he's tried to create an art free from taste, personal emotions, memory, and the limits of imagination. About his chance compositions, Cage has written, "There's many who say, if music's that easy to write, I could do it. Of course they could, but they don't," he said. Cage's philosophy, his music, and writings have been of enormous influence to artists in every medium, as has his lectures, for which he's also famous. And by the way, he's also an expert on mushrooms. The museum will have a couple of special events this weekend in conjunction with their Cage exhibit, and I'd like to mention them for you. Tomorrow at 2:30, David Tudor will be performing music by John Cage, and Sunday at 2:30, there will be a lecture by Pattison Sims of the Whitney Museum on the subject John Cage and His Friends, Chance and Intelligence. John Cage, welcome to Fresh Air. It's really such a great pleasure to meet you.
Thank you, Terry Gross. It's good to meet you.
I wonder if people ever thought when you were young that radicalism in art was something that you were going to outgrow, that, you know, you'd get more conservative in the kind of work you were doing as you got older.
I remember a lady in Chicago hearing what wild ideas I had in the early 40s. She said, "Oh, when you get older, you'll mellow."
And?
I'm not so sure that I'm mellowing. Some people may think that I am, but my feeling is that if I found a new idea or something that I don't yet know, that would be a great pleasure.
Since you're a celebrated artist now, and nearly everybody who doesn't even listen to new music knows about you and your work, do you find that you're met differently by audiences now, that they're more willing to give themselves over to what you're doing? And
it used to be very difficult to get 120 people together to listen to a program of music. Now I have to refuse many engagements in order to have time to do the next work that I haven't yet done. And I have become, as it were, two people. One who's on paper, or is music and books and prints, and the other one who isn't any of those things, but who has an idea about making the next one. Another thing I do is I fight a war against paper, and in that war I'm on both sides. I both want to get rid of paper and I want to write on more of it. I send my musical materials that come through the mail or that I produce myself to Northwestern University, and I send all things about mushrooms or nature in general the University of California at Santa Cruz, that used to have a marvelous garden project run by Alan Chadwick. Did you ever hear his name?
I don't think so.
He was an amazing gardener. And he also knew the wild mushrooms. I went hunting with him once, and he ran like a pony and at the same time was reciting poetry. He was a marvelous man, and I'd no sooner given my collection of mushroom books to the university because of him, and it was a collection of over 300 items, than he had some quarrel with the university and left. But the books were planted there, and many people have become interested in mushrooms through them, even one who's written a book subsequently on mushrooms.
If I may quote you from one of your books, you wrote, what was it that actually made me choose music rather than painting? Just because they said nicer things about my music than they did about my paintings? But I don't have absolute pitch. I can't keep a tune. In fact, I have no talent for music. The last time I saw her, Aunt Phoebe said, you're in the wrong profession.
Right.
Why did you choose, did you really feel that way about your music? And if so, why did you choose music over painting?
Well, my father was an inventor. And I've never thought that, as many people do, that music should be in my head, and that I should learn how to write down what I already hear. I really can't hold a tune, and I don't know solfège at all. So that I found ways of writing music to produce sounds that I haven't heard and that other people haven't heard. If I'd studied solfège, if I had a feeling for harmony, which I don't, I think I would simply write what people have already heard or what I would have thought I heard. The result is I have a curious feeling every time I write a new piece, particularly one for orchestra that involves so many people and so much trouble, you know, to bring it into existence. I think up until the last minute that maybe it's just going to be a great mistake or that we won't discover anything with it. But so far, I've been very fortunate. And the last piece, maybe you heard it Sunday, the dance for orchestras, I was delighted with, and I think the musicians themselves were.
So you have to listen to your pieces as they're being done in probably a different way than most composers listen to
their work. I hear them for the first time, and I hear them with interest rather than critically.
What's the difference? Do you like? Do you try to judge between?
You wouldn't think, would you, when you're looking at a sunset of criticizing it? You'd rather look at it attentively to see what there was there, and I think that's my way of listening, particularly to a performance that I haven't heard before, whether my music or someone else's. I try to hear what there is to hear.
So you won't walk away thinking, that was a real success, or that was a terrible failure, I won't do that again.
No, not that.
I think when you were studying with Schoenberg, and this is an indirect quote, he said something like, you don't have an ear for harmonies, and that will always be for you like walking against, like knocking into a wall. And you said, in that case, I'll bang my head against that wall for the rest of my career.
Right.
And a lot of your work hasn't been about that relationship of sounds to other sounds, but of sounds in and of themselves, individual sound, sound for itself. Is that too, do you think, from not wanting to work with harmony?
I had an interest in each single sound from the beginning, and at first I began putting the sounds together as I'd been taught, into motives and repeating them and varying them, but gradually and through a study of Oriental philosophy and through the use of chance operations I have found ways, I think, of letting sounds move from their own centers rather than centers in my mind, or relationships in my mind.
What's your attitude towards random sounds in your home? I'm thinking now of...
I just love them.
Like apartments in Manhattan, which is probably the noisiest city in the world.
I live on, and Sixth Avenue is very, very noisy. And sometimes... you probably have it here in Philadelphia too, there are burglar alarms.
Oh, yeah.
And they may last 3 or 4 hours. It's quite that's quite a problem. I think that we almost have an instinct to be annoyed by a burglar alarm. But as I pay attention to them, they're curiously, slightly varying.
What if you're paying attention to something else at the same time?
Well, I think that one of our most accessible disciplines now is paying attention to more than one thing at a time. And if we can do that with equanimity, then I would suggest paying attention to three things at the same time. And you can practice that as a discipline. I think it's more effective than sitting cross-legged.
In what way?
I mean to say cross-legged in relation
to... In meditation.
Yes. It opens the... I think the meaning of meditation is to open the doors of the ego from a concentration on itself to a flow with all of creation, wouldn't you say? And if we can do this through the sense perceptions, through multiplying the things to which we're able at one and the same time to pay attention, I think we accomplish much the same thing. At least that's my faith.
So you don't shut yourself in and try to make things very quiet so you can concentrate on what you're doing?
No. One of the lectures that Suzuki gave that impressed me so much was on the structure of the mind, and he drew a kind of an oval on the board, and he put two parallel lines halfway up the left-hand side. And he said, this is the structure of the mind, and this is the ego, those two parallel lines. And the ego goes out through the sense perceptions to the world of relativity, or it goes in through dreams to the absolute. And then the fact that it was a continuous line, like a circle or like an oval, made me have the faith that instead of sitting cross-legged or doing special things about Zen Buddhism, that I could continue with my music and treat it in a disciplined way through the use of chance operations, so that instead of expressing myself, as so many artists think their responsibility is, I could alter myself so that I would flow with my experience.
So
that's been my project.
It's interesting, you know, some people when they start studying something like Zen Buddhism think that this means they'd better go to the Far East and live in the mountains and join a monastery.
Right. But you know, Isamu Noguchi says that nowadays New York is the most Japanese city in the world.
What does he mean by that?
And that Tokyo is the most... American or the most up to the minute. Well, he means what we experience when we're in one place or the other. And I think that we have a kind of a Japanese feeling in New York now. Just as the last time I was in Japan, I noticed that the extraordinary comfort in hotels was something that we don't know at all. We are, after all, the oldest country, as Gertrude Stein said, of the 20th century. So we made mistakes, and a place like Japan is profiting from all of that in order to put technology to use in a way that is correct. When you go into a hotel room in Tokyo, as I did recently, every one of your wishes or comforts has been thought of. And if you just look around, you'll see that there's almost nothing that you need that hasn't been provided, down to thread and needle.
Those little shower caps and
all kinds of
shampoos. you said at one point that your problems in your performances were becoming not musical but social, and that you saw composing as a way of instructing people's behavior, controlling people's behavior, and you wanted to get out of that. So what's the difference between composing and having people perform it, composing through like traditional methods, and composing through chants? Is it a different way of shaping someone's behavior when you're working through chants processes?
No, chants is one thing, and working with music as though it were a social situation that was a desirable social situation is something else, and has led me to think of what we call indeterminacy. In other words, making my music so that it doesn't force the performers of it into a particular groove, but which gives them some space in which they can breathe and do their own work with a degree of originality.
Do you like to speak with performers before they perform one of your pieces, if it's people who you know?
I like to make suggestions and then see what happens, rather than setting down laws and forcing people to follow them.
And you're really curious to see how the sounds are going to come out. It's not like you know how it's supposed
to
sound.
Since I don't hear music in my head to begin with, I don't lose anything at all by leaving a little more freedom. In fact, the use of chance operations leads to a certain freedom, and the providing of suggestion rather than law leads to another, adds to it.
You've like rejected taste and memory in the chance processes work. What's restricting about taste and memory for you?
There's a beautiful remark of Marcel Duchamp, whose work is here at the museum. To reach the impossibility of transferring from one like object to another the memory imprint. And I think the trouble with memory, both from a poetic point of view, is made clear too by the remark of René Char, the French poet, that each act is virgin, even the repeated one. To see things as being new rather than things that we already know before we're experiencing them. I think this is one of the things that leads to trouble between two people when someone says of another person, I knew what she would say, or I knew what he would say. I would hope that we don't get into that frame of mind with respect to one another.
Yeah, it's interesting to me because you have such a really rich and detailed memory and use it so beautifully in your storytelling and in your writings, which become your pieces also. So I know that memory does come into play.
There's another remark I've come across in the last year or so that I like, and it's by the composer Erik Satie. And it's related to that remark that I just quoted from Char, each act is virgin. Satie says, experience is a form of paralysis. Do you see the relation? If we think we know what the other person is going to say, and if we don't approach things as virgin, then our minds and our attitudes to our life become paralyzed. And that's why we want to have each thing new. To realize that two Coca-Cola bottles are not identical. And what makes them not identical is that they're not at the same point. They can't be at the same point in space. Since they're not at the same point in space, they automatically receive, each one receives light differently than the other, so that it can be as fascinating as going to a museum to look carefully, attentively at two Coca-Cola bottles. And something of that is implicit in a great deal of 20th century art.
John Cage is my guest if you're just joining us, and he's celebrating his 70th birthday, and there's a special exhibit of his work at the museum that opens tomorrow, with also a performance by David Tudor tomorrow at 2:30. You know, that kind of perception, I think sometimes, like when you walk into a museum or a concert hall, it's like your senses get turned on because you're gonna be paying money, you're walking in, you're going here especially to experience something sensual, whereas when you go to work in the morning or when you're going to take the subway or something, you kind of turn down a lot of those senses. You're not expecting a sensual experience, and you're maybe expecting things that you're not going to want to see or hear too much.
It's marvelous, though, when we are surprised by coincidences of light or sound and our presence. That's one of the beautiful things about hunting mushrooms, is that they grow up and are fresh at just a particular moment. And our lives are actually characterized by moments.
I think your life is like this great dialectic between things like between computers and the I Ching, or between having to know what mushroom to pick so that you don't kill yourself and your friends by doing the poisonous one, and then using chance processes for your music and poetry. Do you consciously decide which each of those will be, or do you just kind of naturally have those interests in
I think we
both
should,
sides?
We can tell rather clearly when we're in what the Indians call an artha circumstance, which is a circumstance where you have a goal and you don't want to kill yourself, or you want to win as in a game, or you want to cross the street without getting killed, or you want to hunt wild mushrooms and not kill yourself, and so on. That's one way of living. Another way of living is having and giving pleasure, kama. And another way is following the good rather than the evil. I think which is dharma in Indian philosophy, is very close to what in Christianity is faith, hope, and charity, such things. And then in Buddhism there is moksha, which is liberation from all those three concerns. And normally if we went to school, we would think, well, we start in artha, we go to kama, we go to dharma, and we graduate and get into moksha. But I think the truth of the matter is that we're in all four all of the time, and that we live a life characterized by inconsistency.
Well, another thing that sounds...
And that's the marvelous... thing. You can then write a poem, as the Japanese monk did, on having reached enlightenment. You can say, now that I'm enlightened, I'm just as miserable as ever.
I like to think of I like to think,
and that characterizes, you know, the way we feel, don't you think?
Yeah, yeah. Well,
and say you get exhausted toward the end of the day, and don't you have the experience of finding life not quite so bad the next morning when you wake up, full of new energy?
Yeah, I like to think of you and Marcel Duchamp playing chess together. Because here...
Well, we actually didn't play
much. You didn't
play?
No.
Oh. I played with Tini Duchamp, his wife, and he would criticize our game. And he said to me once, he said, don't you ever want to win?
Yeah, did you play to win when you played chess?
I didn't then. I played chess in order to be with him. I wanted to be with him as much as possible. Now that he's dead, my game is improved.
Did you talk much during those chess games with Tini?
No, I had a kind of confidence that if I was just near Duchamp, that would be enough, that I didn't have to ask him questions or converse. Once I remember he said, let's sit down and have a conversation. We sat down and I don't remember what we talked about. I just liked being with him.
Was that so, that being with him and not talking got for you some of what you wanted to be?
Yes, I think his presence, his being, was both question and answer. Hmm?
Did you talk much about art?
No.
Did you know that he was doing that piece that
no,
no one knew that
no,
he was
I
doing
didn't
this
know
at the
it
museum?
Either. I didn't know it either. I didn't know it until after he died, and then Tini Duchant took me to see it in New York before it moved here to Philadelphia.
Did you feel cheated by that?
No. No, no, I thought it was marvelous that he had led us to believe that he had given up working and that all the time he was busy as a bird dog.
You know, since he's the kind of artist that a lot of people, I think, wanted to copy his behavior as much as...
He meant by that he had gone underground.
Uh-huh.
He used to say an artist must go underground in order to get anything done. And he needed, I think, in his work, as I have trained myself not to need, he needed solitude in which to work. I can work, I have studied being interrupted, and I can work whether I have solitude or not. I've had to do that because of my association with dancers. But another thing that Marcel used to talk about in those last years of his life, and which recurred in his conversation, not with me, but I noticed when other people were in the room, he somehow would arrange it so that it came up. He said, why is it that artists are willing for people to look at their work from any distance? And he, of course, was thinking of the Étant Donné, in which he obliges them to look through the peephole of the door. But no one had thought, before he thought of it, of making such a situation in which he would control the position of the observer, and for him to control who had been the one to remove control from art. Hmm? That was what was so marvelous about him, was doing two great works, the Étant Donné and the big and the large glass, and have them be essentially so paradoxical in relation to one another.
You said that his work was both the question and the answer. Mm. For your work, you ask a lot of questions.
Yes, instead of making choices.
I was really struck when I heard you speak a couple of years ago by something you said. You know, someone had asked you about, you know, why you make choices in that way, I think, and you said, well, anytime you make a choice, you're choosing one thing over another, and you've eliminated something from your life that might have been really, really interesting in and of its own right.
Mm-hmm.
What about in your personal life? How do you make choices? In ordinary ways, or?
Well, lately, with respect to food, I've made the choice of the macrobiotic diet, and I find that I am much healthier. I had very bad arthritis for 15 years. I took 12 aspirin a day.
Really?
And there was no other thing suggested by the doctors, and I could see that the arthritis was getting worse rather than better, and that the pain would come back unless I kept taking the aspirin. So I began to complain to my friends, and among them were John and Yoko. And Yoko said, you must go to Shizuko. Shizuko Yamamoto, she will change your diet and give you shiatsu massage. And I went to her almost immediately, and she told me how to change the diet. And within, it's hard to believe, but within 1 week, I had no pain. And my wrists used to be very, very thick and what do you call it?
Swollen?
Swollen. And now I'm distorted somewhat, but they're not swollen. And I have no pain. I couldn't have picked up a cup without using both hands at that time. Now I can do all sorts of things.
Did pain affect your art, do you think? I ask you that because I know for myself that pain is the most distracting thing. And it's hard, I find for myself, it's hard to enjoy things when you're in pain, and it's hard to think clearly.
If you work as I do with it in a disciplined way, then I think it's precisely when one's working that one overcomes pain or overcomes unhappiness. Do you know that rather alarming Zen story where the mother is crying? And the monk says, "What are you crying about?" And she said, "I've just lost my only son." And then he hits her over the head, and he says, "There, that will give you something to cry about." That's a rather shocking story, but I was in Japan, as I told you, and I was waiting to be on a television program, and the lady who was going to be my translator told me that she had lost her only son. And that she had tried many ways to become consoled, and that nothing worked for her. That Christianity had not worked, that Zen Buddhism had not worked, nothing worked. And I said to her, "How do you feel in this work of translating?" And she said, "Well, while I'm working, I feel better." Do you see? When the mind is struck over its head in such a way as to give itself up, either through employment or through being hit by a stick, by someone with a stick, at that point, one is more able to see out rather than to concentrate on over and over again on the same thing that one is sad about.
I've never really understood that story before. It's one I've heard through your writing. Really, frankly, has always baffled me.
Right.
I'd like to play a selection from one of the records of your work that was recently issued, and it's from an album called, you pronounce this for me,
Etude Austral.
Austral, okay, good. And would you explain...
Or Australis. It's the same word as Australia.
Right.
It's the southern sky, and I used maps of the southern sky and chance operations to make these piano etudes.
What kinds of chance operations did you use for this one, and then we'll listen to some.
I always use the I Ching. And now, instead of tossing three coins six times to get the hexagrams, I have, since the late 60s, used a computer printout. When I made that piece called Harpsichord with Lajaran Hiller, the I Ching was programmed. And I have it, but it couldn't be extracted from the Harpsichord program, but another separate program was made for me. And nowadays, if I travel, say, to Paris, and I'm at IRCOM, as I was, and I'm running out of my printout, they say, "Oh, don't worry, we have it in our computer."
We're going to hear Gret Sultan at the piano. Did you talk at all before the realization of this?
Did I what?
Did you both talk together before this recording was made about the pieces?
Oh, she's worked now for many years. On these etudes, these are the first 16 that were published by Tomato, and now she's going to record this fall the second 16. She plays all 32 now.
Well, let's listen to her at the piano playing the first etude from these Etude Austral for piano by John Cage, and just a reminder that there is an exhibit of his scores and prints that opens tomorrow at the Philadelphia Museum.
Could I suggest that you play not the first one, but something farther along, like 8 or
sure.
Anything after 8.
Anything after 8?
Or anything really after 1.
Okay. Well, why don't we play something after 8, which means, Paul, why don't you flip over the the record? Why?
Well, the first etude is characterized by single notes, and there are very few aggregates. And the piece as a whole has more aggregates the farther along you get in it. And somehow they're very interesting because some of them are consonant and familiar, like triads, and others are complex and not familiar at all. I made a list of all the things that a single hand could reach in the way of a four-note chord without the assistance of the other hand. Guess how many?
How many?
Guess.
Oh, 1,000?
Oh, you're the first person who's guessed more than there actually are.
Generally, someone would say
75 or something. But there are 640,
really?
Which is quite amazing. 640 different kinds of chords, you see.
I only guessed 1,000 because I figured, gosh, it must be really high.
Uh-huh.
I wouldn't have thought that, really. Well, let's listen to Power of Suggestion. Let's listen to one of the etudes. Do we have that ready to go? Okay, and this is, what number do we have? Number 5? And 5 is 10, number 10. Number 5. Okay. We had Greg Sultan at the piano playing the fifth etude from John Cage's Etude Austral for piano, which was recently issued on Tomato Records, and she'll be performing the other 16 sometime.
Right, this fall.
Yeah, you were mentioning as we were listening to that, that every so often there'd be a normal, an ordinary, a predictable, no, I can't come out with the right word
regular,
here.
That's a regular triad.
Regular triad, or right. And it would sound so unusual in the setting of so many unpredictable, unusual sounds.
Right, more complex aggregates.
I want to mention that John Cage is my guest, and on the month of his 70th birthday, there's an exhibit that will be opening tomorrow at the Philadelphia Museum of Art of his scores and prints. And there's a couple of other related events I'd like to just call your attention to. David Tudor will be performing works by John Cage tomorrow at 2:30. And there's going to be a lecture Sunday at 2:30. And it will be Patterson Sims, an associate curator at the Whitney Museum. And the subject of his lecture will be John Cage and His Friends, Chance and Intelligence. Can I quote you again? You've said, where there's a history of organization, introduce disorder. Where there's a history of disorganization, introduce order.
Mm.
Can you think of times when you've introduced order into your art where there's been a history of disorganization? Has there ever been a situation?
Well,
like that?
What I was thinking of when I made the remark was that in the world of art, where there's been established relationships, that there we need the freedom given by irrationality. Whereas in the treatment of the relation between a society and the world on which we live, there has been a kind of idiotic mishandling of natural resources, and I think Buckminster Fuller has a very clear and useful way to bring about an equation, a proper relationship, a proper organization between nature and society, human beings. And we need that very much. We don't need to have rivers that could burst into flame, you know?
There's a difference between chance and anarchy, isn't there?
I think of chance as a discipline, and many people think of anarchy as throwing caution to the winds. I would want, and I think we do need, a world without nations. I think we need an intelligent plan, such as Buckminster Fuller's, for arranging matters so that everyone can live as he needs.
Did Suzuki, did D.T. Suzuki ever get to hear much of your music? And I wonder what he thought of the uses you were making of the I Ching.
Well, when I remember going to him once and asking him a question about music, because I wanted to know from him whether I was going, in quote, in the right direction by using chance operations. And he very quickly said to me, "I know nothing about music." I think that was not true, but what he meant was that I had to make up my own mind and not have him make it up for me.
So it was basically, he didn't give you any feedback.
Right, right.
Okay. I'd like to listen to another recent recording of some of your music, and this is from the Sonatas and Interludes, and I'd like to play the first interlude.
Okay.
From here. How does that sound to you? And do you want to say anything about the writing or the composing of this? Do you explain?
Of one of the sonatas or the interlude?
We can hear the first interlude.
This is for the prepared piano, which was, and it was a composition that, not this single one, but the whole group of compositions were written over a period of 2 years. And so they used the same preparation, the same placing of objects in the strings. I found the sounds the way you find shells when you walk along the beach. And so the piano became a collection of sounds, and the music used that collection. The sonatas used it in order to make pieces that had two repeated parts, whereas the interlude, which we're going to hear, doesn't have any repeated parts. It goes, starts out, and it's like a little adventure.
Okay, let's hear the first interlude, and Joshua Pierce is featured at the piano from Sonatas and Interludes by John Cage. From Sonatas and Interludes, that was the first interlude by John Cage, and Joshua Pierce was at the piano from one of a series of albums recently issued on Tomato Records. John Cage is my guest, and there's an exhibit of his prints and scores that opens tomorrow at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, and David Tudor will be performing some of Cage's work Saturday afternoon beginning at 2:30. That was nice.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was really nice sounds. From the piano. Do you know what you're going to get? Can you, at this point, having worked with prepared piano, pretty much tell what kind of object in the strings will produce what kind of sound?
To a certain extent. On the other hand, if you try to repeat the preparation from one piano to another, you'll find it's quite impossible. So you really... It was partly this experience of not being able to repeat the sounds of one piano on another that led me to the notions and ideas that I've developed. In other words, not to want to repeat, to give up the desire rather than to insist upon it. Had I insisted upon repeating, I perhaps might have succeeded in some way, but I would have become closed in by that success. Whereas by giving up the desire to repeat, my life has opened up to the acceptance of many circumstances that otherwise would have irritated me beyond measure.
I think musicians who play in every kind of music have been affected by your thought and your music. Do you keep up with who's playing what, particularly those people who obviously have paid a lot of attention to your work? And are there people who whose work especially interests you now?
I'm very interested in the work that David Tudor is doing, and I look forward to the program that he'll play tomorrow afternoon. He's an extraordinary musical source of music. He comes from around this city. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that. Mm-hmm.
And when he was 12 years old, he was a professional organist here in Philadelphia.
Really? Mm-hmm. You've had a very long collaboration.
Right. And we haven't worked closely together except in relation to the Cunningham Dance Company. We haven't worked closely together for nearly 20 years now. But the 20 years before that, we did work very closely together.
Do you use dreams much in your work at all, or as a source of inspiration for your work?
I had very clearly about, I don't know whether it's 2 or 3 years ago, I had the experience of a great closeness between the night and the day. And I was working on a text called James Joyce, Marcel Duchamp, and Eric Satie, and Alphabet. And I didn't actually dream the text, but I found a way of using my faculties, not in deep sleep, but after, say, 3 hours, 3 or 4 hours of deep sleep, in a kind of thing that corresponds to daydreaming, but that you might call it night dreaming, in which you're not really, you're not deeply asleep, of finding a way to bring that way of thinking and feeling into the day when I woke up. And it worked for me for about 6 weeks, during which I was writing that text. And I was able to feel that by going to sleep, that my work was continuing rather than not. I haven't had that experience as clearly since then as I had it at that time. And I would like to have it again. I remember when I was much younger, enjoying the business of dreaming that I was flying. Did you ever dream that?
Oh, yeah.
I liked it so much that I wanted to get to be able to control it so that I could say, well, now we'll dream that we're flying. And I found I couldn't do that. Could you?
No, but I've never... I don't know, it's always seemed kind of pointless to me to figure out what to dream that night, because first of all, I know I couldn't possibly do it. Second of all, so kind of surprising to see what's been programmed for mm-hmm. you that night. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of cartoon drawing flying films where I kind of like fly like a cartoon character
yes,
would.
Yes, yes.
And I go up and never seem to come down again. It's like out of my control. Well, you know, it's interesting that so many so much of the avant-garde eventually becomes a tradition in some way. Has it been interesting for you to observe that? I don't know if you'd even agree with the premise. But
you mean, well, things...
Well, like the prepared piano.
Right,
I mean, that's in every form of music now. It's not necessarily even a piano that's mm-hmm. prepared, but people are like, you know, smacking their instruments and bowing them and sticking things inside of it. And it's all basically influenced uh-huh. by your ideas of broadening the concept of what the instrument can do. And it's an accepted part of the vocabulary of music now.
Well, I think it's given a lot of pleasure.
Yeah, yeah.
To make those explorations. You know, it was assumed that a wind instrument could only play one tone, whereas now the term multiphonics is in the language.
Well, your work and writing have given me and countless other people a great deal of pleasure. I want to wish you a happy birthday.
Well, thank you very much.
And thank you so much
and
for talking.
And when is your birthday?
In February.
Great. Well, happy birthday to you.
Thank you. John Cage has been my guest, and the exhibit of his scores and prints opens tomorrow at the museum. And there's a couple of special events that I want to remind you of. David Tudor will be playing some of his pieces tomorrow. Do you know what he'll be performing?
I think the solo for piano from the Concert for Piano and Orchestra. He has a marvelous electronic version of it.
Great, and that will be tomorrow at 2:30, and Sunday at 2:30. Patterson Sims of the Whitney Museum will be speaking on the subject, John Cage and his friends, Chance and Intelligence. Well, I'd like to, by way of closing, play another selection, and this is She is Asleep, a 1943 composition for voice and prepared piano, and the pianist is Joshua Pierce, who we heard before, and the vocalist is Jay Clayton.
She has a beautiful voice.
She does. Do you want to say a little bit about this before we hear it?
It was going to be a part long composition that would take the whole evening, but only the first few parts were written. She is Asleep, both for 12 tom-toms, and then this song with prepared piano, and then another piece which is called A Room.
Let's hear it. John Cage's She Is Asleep, we heard the portion duet for voice and prepared piano, and the voice was that of Jay Clayton. The prepared piano was played by Joshua Pierce.